It's great to be here. I really love Warwick's, and I had a great event back. I think it was 2006, actually. So it's great to be here again. The last event was for the Republican War on Science, as you heard, and the new book, Unscientific America, really is. I'm thinking of it as the sequel to the first one, and written for the Obama years, much as the Republican War was pretty explicitly written for the Bush years. And I guess maybe if you compare the covers, you can sort of see that, because we've gone from a big, stupid elephant that trampled the test tube to the test tube still broken, but you can't really tell what the cause is anymore. It's not as obvious anymore. And I think that really does summarize the difference. Let me say a little bit about how I got from one book to the other. The Republican War on Science, as many of you know, it argued that under the Bush administration, science was under attack throughout the government on very important policy issues like global warming, stem cells, and many others. And so inevitably, I went out to lecture about it. And in my early talks, my strategy for telling people about the book, including here and many other places, was to sort of unveil a by now familiar litany of abuses, all of the ways in which the administration had messed with science in some way. And that talk inevitably prompted a lot of outrage on the part of the audience, a lot of frustration. At the end of the talk, people, the hands would go up, and the question kept recurring. Members of the audience would say, "You've got me really wound up. You've got me really angry. You made me want to punch a wall. I cannot believe this kind of stuff is going on in my government. You haven't given me any release. You haven't told me what I can do about this problem." And I realized that my instinctual answer to that question, which was go buy the book, right, was insufficient. So inevitably, I started looking for new answers, new solutions to what was really a broad science, politics, society disconnect. And so some of the answers I started thinking about were things like, you know, how could the Bush administration get away with it? Was it something about American culture that let this abuse of science seem normal? Was it something about the media? And was a new way of thinking about the communication of science part of the answer? In other words, you could say I was starting to think about a set of underlying problems that were going to be with us and remain with us long after Bush's party had been thrown out of the White House. And around the same time, I also teamed up with a young marine biologist named Cheryl Kirschenbaum, who is the second author on this book. She's my co-blogger, my co-author, and, you know, someone I talk to every day about all of this stuff. And getting to know her and working with her really made me aware in a way that I wasn't before of what it is like to be a young scientist today, and also made me aware of the growing number of young researchers like herself who have taken a kind of career departure, in her case, going to work in Washington, D.C. on Capitol Hill in a senator's office and then becoming a blogger and a writer rather than going back to get her PhD, because she and many other young scientists today really feel like, I mean, they love the research and they think hard about that career, but a lot of them think, well, maybe I'd like to do something more to help science connect to society. And it's really inspiring, actually, to work with someone like that. And we worked not only on the blog and later the book, but we worked on an initiative which many of you, I think, have probably heard of. And we devoted a full chapter of the book to this. And you could say that it was one of the key things that inspired the book. And the initiative was called Science Debate 2008. And this was something that we co-founded with a pair of Hollywood screenwriters and a couple of other people, just basically a call for a presidential debate on science. And all of the organizations of American science loved this idea. They signed on. We had something like 38,000 individuals, 100 universities, scores of scientific societies, Nobel laureates, anybody you could think of that mattered in science thought this was a good idea. How could you be against a presidential science debate? And this taught us quite a lesson about politics. And the lesson was, you know, you build it, they won't necessarily come. and trying to think about why all of science saying to the candidates, we need to hear from you, was not enough, further got us thinking about why there's such a huge disconnect between science and society in the U.S. So Unscientific America was the result of all these processes. It's our attempt to understand the problem of why science just doesn't get through to the people who need it most. And we're not just talking about the public, but we're talking about particular segments of the public, the politicians, the journalists, the entertainers, the religious leaders, and their followers, which we address in sequence. And in all of these places, there are a lot of blocks that prevents scientific information from getting through as it ought to. And I'll just briefly give you some data. The book is full of it. And, you know, just last week, the Pew Organization, or this week, came out with a boatload of new data on just how bad the situation is, the gap between science and the public. I mean, I think we all agree there's a scientific literacy problem. You know, not nearly enough Americans can tell you the Earth rotates around the sun and takes a year to do it. You know, trying to get them to explain why the seasons change on top of that is just an insane request. They get the question wrong. What's larger, an electron or an atom? Obviously, evolution, 46%, you heard before, thinks the Earth is less than 10,000 years old. We argue in the book that knowledge of the facts is really bad, but it's not just about the facts. For example, I think it's just as significant that scientists in our society today are not regarded as role models or much looked up to. 44% of Americans cannot even name a scientific role model. And among those few who do, let me tell you what the top answers are. Bill Gates, Al Gore, and Albert Einstein. So people are either not scientists or not alive. You know, all the data shows that Americans don't hate science. They don't have anything against it, but it's not on the radar. It's not central to their lives. And this is a bad situation to be in when you consider just how much science is going to shape policy and going to shape the future, and that's what really worries us. And that's why we ended writing a book which is basically about the failure of translation of science, not the failure of research, because research has been very successful. We want more money for it. But clearly we know how to do it, but we don't know how to translate science into different spheres of American life. And this translation is a critical issue today, not just because after global warming and stem cells there's going to be a new generation of science policy controversies, and we try to guess what some of them are. You can't fully predict, but we know they're coming. But also because we live in a time of media upheaval when science journalists are vanishing from the traditional press, and it's not clear who, if anyone, is going to take their place. The translators might end up having to be the scientists themselves, because it's hard to believe that we can really rely on the journalists to translate scientific knowledge to the broader society if we ever could rely upon them. And I just want to add also a thing that I think is different about the book, a thing that I'm proud of, and a thing that I think is really important, is that when it comes to the failure of translating scientific knowledge, we don't just point the finger and say, it's your fault, you over there. We don't say, you know, people in politics are just cynical and that's the problem. We don't say average Americans are just stupid and that's the problem. And we don't say people who are religious are just brainwashed and that's the problem. We try to take a different approach in honor of C.P. Snow. We adopt a two cultures analysis and we say, you know, there is a divide, it's obvious, there's two groups that don't see eye to eye. But rather than staring across the divide at the other group and saying, you people need to move toward me, we say, maybe we should think about how can we move towards the other group. And I think if that message is resonating now, and I suspect it might be, it's because think about where we find ourselves, the world of science. I'm not a scientist, but I'm a science journalist. Today, basically, you know, for 50 years in the United States, post-Sputnik, magnificent research has been done. Incredible innovations that we're all proud of, reaching the moon, decoding the genome, creating the internet, all the rest. But what are we not so proud of? Over those years, much of the public didn't come along on the incredible odyssey of discovery, and over that time, the scientists didn't learn nearly as much about how to reach them as they learned about how to understand nature. And that is an imbalance that it is finally time to address. And I think that message is catching on within the scientific community itself. And so finally, as we argue in the book, and we can talk about this more, this mission of bringing that back into balance is going to have to fall to the young scientists today, I think. And I just want to end with a quotation of what things should be like when we get there, and then we'll do the conversation with Roger. This is a quotation from Matthew Chapman, a screenwriter and great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin, who I worked with in the Science Debate Initiative. This is what we want to achieve. Instead of being derided as geeks or nerds, scientists should be seen as courageous realists and the last great heroic explorers of the unknown. They should get more money, more publicity, better clothes, more sex, and free rehab when the fame goes to their heads.
So we are at Warwick's in La Jolla. with Chris Mooney to discuss his book, Unscientific America. Let me just start with the little letter that came out with the book when I got it from the from your publicist. I'm not saying this is your fault, okay, but it does say, I hope you'll enjoy this eye-opening book which sounds the alarm about the disappearance of science from America's cultural and educational landscape. Okay, now, I was pleased when the new, I prefer to call it an administration rather than a regime, came in, with our president who said he wanted to restore science to its rightful place on US agenda, a Speaker of the House who says if you ask her what her agenda is, she says four words, science, 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 and science. I actually know people who are in positions of in the administration now, which is a complete change. So I thought this,
I thought this
was a good shift. So is this a little bit of a knell of doom that is a bit excessive, or are you just...
I think we say in the book, and I wouldn't deny, that with the administration change, Washington has gotten to be a more science-friendly place. I've seen the policies already pretty much unleashed that are designed to deal with the specific kinds of abuses that the Bush administration had committed. I think the stem cell issue might have just been put to bed by the new guidelines. The climate issue, we'll see. Those were the ones that we fought over most during the Bush administration. So I don't think, I wouldn't deny for a second that the president is a completely different thing than George W. Bush was. Very, very pro-science. But that doesn't mean that everything's okay. Right. And it doesn't mean that we have any reason to be complacent. There are a lot of problems, and there's a lot of things that the president alone cannot change. And one of the biggest is the disappearance of science from media. For example, I mean that's a product of market forces. That's a product of the growth of the internet, and we have not sorted that out at all. We don't know if science is going to really reach the broad public again through media.
So the question really is why the disappearance of science from the media? That's the point. And I find this a little bit surprising, since there appears to be, at least to me, a good climate for communication of science. I would say there's a resurgence of interest in this, and I could be completely wrong. But you're certainly the case that if the CNN team, the entire CNN team vanishes, then there's something odd. If Rick Weiss, one of the best journalists there is, vanishes from the Washington Post, although he's now ended up in a good place, there's something very odd. Do you have some sense of why that's happening? And in fact, are you partly responsible because you're blogging science? And
yeah, I'm partly responsible.
Yeah, right.
So, well, first of all, the recession and the implosion of the newspaper industry is the most immediate thing that killed all the whole generation of newspaper science journalists. You know, I'm doing the Knight Fellowship at MIT for science journalism starting in September, and this is a program for science journalists to go into to sort of sharpen up their skills. Well, the last class, it's like 11 journalists. Three of them, you're supposed to go on leave from your job.
Last class?
The last class of before my class. You're supposed to, you know, resume your job as a science journalist once you finish the fellowship. Well, three of them didn't have jobs once they finished the fellowship, and they'd never seen anything like that before. And one of them I talked to was the science one of the science reporters for the San Francisco Chronicle, who lost his job, was sort of a forced buyout situation. This is the guy who's the epidemiology, you know, disease specialist, pushed out right when swine flu hit. You know, the person who would have covered swine flu, gone, right when swine flu happened. So I mean, these are gigantic economic forces that, you know, have nothing to do with the relevance of science to policy today. They have to do with the fact that the newspaper business is falling apart, and the blog business, we argue in the book, is not much of a replacement. It's certainly not going to create careers and salaries that people can build families around, except for maybe a couple of people, but not for the kind of science journals we had before. But also the quality of discussion and the kinds of things that are dealt with are completely different too. So.
Okay, there's a point. There was a point that was made by Natalie Angier. Do you know Natalie Angier's book, The Canon? There's a point in there where she's having a discussion with Peter Galison, who's professor of history of science at Harvard. And Peter says, we've done the impossible. We take these bright little bundles of energy that want to suck up information called kids, and we gradually make them hate science and just beat it out of them.
Yeah.
And we push this rock up to the top of the hill, and there they are all sitting there just and Natalie said the same thing, that you take them to the science festivals, the science fairs, they play with squiggly objects and sticky materials. And then once you're done with that, when they're about 12, you buy the membership at the Museum of Contemporary Art, and that's where you go from there on, because that's the civilized thing to do. I mean, is there something wrong in the way this stuff is communicated?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's not just that, you know, you cease to make them enthralled with science, but you beat them down with facts and memorization, right? I mean, in high school, and that's when I started to hate science, was because I learned that it was a game. I was very good at it. I got, you know, really high AP scores in chemistry and biology. You know, I forget what they were, but I took them all, you know, I did really well. I didn't know anything. I knew nothing. I had memorized everything, and I was scoring extremely high, and I just thought it was a joke, which is how I felt about math, too. So that whole way of educating, I mean, is you know, I think part of the problem. But in the book, we go farther, and we say, fixing education, important, but can only do so much, because that doesn't change. It will never fix some of the real issues that we have. And for an example, this is really shocking. Global warming, if you're a Republican, then the higher your level of education, the less likely you are to believe in scientific reality. But if you're a Democrat, then it's the opposite. The higher your level of education, the more likely you are to believe in scientific reality. And what that shows, and I think if you look at any of the fraught scientific issues, it's the same thing. People who are well-educated find really good justifications for their politics. And they make up all this scientific nonsense that's very compelling. I mean, you can't say that Michael Crichton's high school education failed him. And you can't say that, who's the guy at Princeton? I'm sorry, who's the global warming, the leading physicist? Freeman Dyson. You can't say that his high school education failed him. So, so fix education. But there's also a lot of broader factors in terms of how science gets treated in our society.
So, all right. So let's skip back a book or two then. So yeah. to global warming,
yeah.
The way in which the facts of the matter have been conveyed. I mean, here's an audience of people who are obviously interested in science because they came to see you, or else they were really bored on the street there.
Yeah.
How many of you have actually got an opinion about whether what the general scientific opinion is about global warming is correct or incorrect? I mean, do you buy the general story that there is global warming or not?
Yes.
You do.
The self-selected audience here, but
the fan. Friends of Mooney. all right, so, but one of the problems that I found that bears on what you're talking about is there seems to be a general need in the audiences I talk to, a need for an expectation of certitude. That's what science is supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
So you read a piece of information about what you should do given the disease you're suffering or the issue that you're dealing with. Here's the best evidence, and you expect some certitude from it. And then 6 months later, or 3 months later, you read a paper in which it's been retracted, I'm sorry, there isn't a depression gene, we were wrong about that.
Yeah.
And the sense of certitude and the belief crumbles. And I think I don't know if you'd agree with me, I think one of the things that's important is to try and explain more clearly the methodology of science and what science can do. It's not in the belief business, it's in the doubt business.
Yeah, I think absolutely you're right. But also, I mean, since we cannot, or I believe we cannot easily protect the public against misinformation of the sort that, say, a very sophisticated global warming denier creates, because basically a high school education will not make you immune to that kind of stuff, because it sounds extremely scientific, and it isn't, but you would need to do a lot of research in order to know that. So if we can't have that, we have to have some sense of respect for the process of science, such that people know that if the National Academies says something, then it isn't just a one-off opinion. It's been through a whole process, and that's where their trust should go. But also, the example you give is, this is a media problem, right? I mean, this is, you know, when people have their certitude yanked away from them in that way, it's because of a windshield wiper journalism effect where, you know, drink coffee, don't drink coffee. And journalists leap on one, and then they leap on the other, and people get really pissed, as they should. And that's only going to get worse, I think, when you have trained specialists falling out of the press, because they're the ones who know not to do that.
So you mentioned the Pew report, okay, which came out recently. There was, for the first time, someone, usually these reports go and find out what the public knows and understands about science and inevitably is found wanting, right? This time they asked scientists as well what they thought and who they thought was responsible. And, well, why don't you tell the story?
I think that this is a great new way of doing it, and it's actually, we had no idea what they were doing. But this is the same thing we do. We do a two cultures analysis. The scientists view the world, and the rest of the world views the world, right? And they're completely different. So with global warming, you had those hands. I don't know how many scientists are here, but if it was scientists, it would have been 84%. And if you do the public, it would have been like 49%. And you know, you just go through the list, and it just keeps happening. So no wonder you have two groups that can't communicate with one another. And they do have, of course, there the data about basically ignorance, people not knowing atom larger than electron, that kind of stuff. I mean, it's all in there. But what's new is to structure it that way so that you can see that the scientific worldview is so different. Because then that lets someone like me come along and say, all right, we know that people don't know that much. We know there's lots of problems. But still, the fact that we know that they don't know means that we should be reaching out. It falls to us. Because who else is going to do it? The journalists are falling down. The educational problem is gigantic, and it's not going to be fixed overnight if it's going to be fixed at all. The scientists at least know what's being missed. They at least know what's not getting translated into policy. So can they do more?
So you're a science writer, science. Yeah. You're not a theater critic. Why did you make this choice? I mean, do your parents from have a science background? Or what?
We were having this conversation in the car, and it's so funny because Miriam and I were both turned off by postmodernism when studying English in the 90s in college. And like, what is this nonsense, you know? I want to study something that has actually, you know, I can say something about. I don't understand these words, and they don't mean anything. You know, I want something real. And that, you know, so I just got into science partly through that, and partly my grandfather was a huge influence on me, a very charismatic, entertaining evolutionary biologist who, you know, lived like the, you know, second incarnation of Darwin, and, you know, with a good sense of humor and, you know, liking to drink booze. And, you know, I mean, it's something about that whole, you know, the atheistic, naturalistic life.
Darwin used to smoke. I don't remember the booze bit.
No, but I mean, Darwin would have, you know, anyway. We don't know. But the point is, he acted like this would have been, Darwin would have been partying in this house. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's true. It was a complete construct that was just a wonderful construct that we were all part of. So that whole worldview, I kind of breathed it in very deeply. You know, and so science journalism was eventually sort of came out of that background.
Okay, one of the things that you would hope to get from people who write about science would be a united front, which at this point, I told you we were going to talk about this.
Yes,
you don't exactly have, because some of your fellow bloggers,
yes,
PZ Myers, Feringula, others, and so on. Have taken issue with the book, with your characterization of Myers, and I think a lot of it revolves around two or three pages where you have some unkind words to say about what are being called the new atheists. So that would include PZ, it would include Richard Dawkins, it would include Sam Harris, it would include Chris Hitchens. I should, by way of disclosure, we do a meeting called Beyond Belief on the Science Network, and you can watch all three of them on there. which have some of this discussion on there, and Chris and Cheryl were at the last one, in fact, so they gave a nice presentation there. But so why have we got in a book about scientific literacy stuff about God?
Oh, I think it's the elephant in the room. I mean, if America has a problem with science, and I think most of us think that there's probably something to that, I don't think you can discuss that without talking about religion. Because I agree with the new atheists that religion is one major thing that keeps people from accepting science. And all the polling data is clear. It says that if people think that science is in conflict with their beliefs, then people say, to hell with science, I'm keeping my beliefs. And that's wrong, but that is really the reality out there in America. So what we do is we just make a simple argument. We say, do we have to fight over this? To me, the answer is no, we don't have to fight over it. To me, in some ways, the new atheists are mirror opposites of Christian conservatives. Christian conservatives basically say, I've got my religion and it's in conflict with science. New atheists say, I've got my science and it's in conflict with religion. Most of America really wants to have both. And I think the polling data, inferences from it, support this, that if you take away the sense that science is an assault on their faith, then you open them up to science. That's the argument.
Let me take a piece from PCs, and we're not going to do this to death, but just there's a reasonable point here, which I know you'll want to answer. They quote your conclusion that science is not merely culture's essential component. We don't just have to mend the rift between science and culture. We have to create a perfect union. Science itself must become the common culture. He agrees wholeheartedly with that comment, and then he says, but how exactly are we to accomplish it without challenging anti-scientific attitudes? In other words, he's saying you can't just say, let's make nice.
Well, first of all, it's about how you challenge it. So, for example, in the book, we extol Sagan. And Sagan was, you know, not a religious believer, and he explained all of the reasons for not believing. But he also was, I think, very respectful toward religion, and ultimately wanted to make common cause with religious believers on matters like arms control, you know, things that were really politically important to him. You should always debunk nonsense. There's always a place for doing that. Atheistic arguments have been in the public square and will remain in the public square. You know, they've been in it for hundreds of years, and they will remain there, and there's no threat to that. But at the same time, if you look at why is America having such problems with science, you can't get away from the fact that they think it's an assault on religion. So if we want to bring them along, it's clear that attacking religion is not going to be the way of doing it. It should be done something that's done with much more sense of where they're actually coming from. Okay, so I should add, I mean, obviously I'm an atheist. I might have been excommunicated now, but
how can you?
But I'm an atheist. Yeah, that's a joke.
Yes.
But I don't. I think that my atheism is a philosophy, and I think that science is not the same as my atheism, and that science is something that everyone can agree on, and then have their personal philosophy. And I think that if we're ever going to get along in a society, it's going to have to be something like that, right? Because everyone's always going to have different views. And science should be the body of information that unites us. If we try, as the new atheists do, to say science also, in some sense, leads to know God, then I think that we're telling some people that they can't have science.
On your blog, just a couple of things, and then we should talk to the audience here. On your blog, I remember reading that you'd done a visiting fellowship recently somewhere, wasn't there?
I've been at Princeton.
Been at Princeton. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, and you actually wrote about Francis Bacon, which, as you know, is a passion of mine.
Oh, really? Yeah.
At the ASU panel recently, I did a panel called The Merchants of Light, which was specifically about the mm-hmm. fact that Bacon had written the New Atlantis, mm-hmm. that there's the island where the only item of commerce going out there is light, the light of understanding, and mm-hmm. we call them the Merchants of Light. Next year is the 350th anniversary of the Royal Society's foundation, mm-hmm. which is really the first instantiation of Bacon's ideas, which is a community of scholars, and you also have a journal. You know, Oldenburg sets up the Philosophical Transaction of the Royal Society. So you have this huge enterprise of science starting mm-hmm. 350 years ago. Our next meeting, the next Beyond Belief, will in fact look at the state of science as it is, as sort of almost as if it was a board meeting, and see how the business is doing. Are you optimistic that we're going to get to that sort of phrase, to just see these as little squabbles along the way? I mean, do you have that same visionary zeal that Bacon had and so on?
Oh, gosh. I do. I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't think that we would be healthier as a people if we had a culture that was more infused with knowledge, basically. I mean, and I think we share that. I was studying the history of science at Princeton, so it makes you a little, a little hesitant about the most glorious dreams of the Enlightenment, which sure. tend to come crashing down. So with that caveat, I think that we have to include everything we've learned since the days when the people thought that science and reason were going to fix everything in society, and we got to temper that optimism with a bit of realism about, you know, politics and how people are. But that doesn't mean we can't do a lot better. Yeah. Basically. Yeah.
But the point I would add to an agreement with that is that, having taught some classes recently, one of the things that is painfully missing mm-hmm. is any sense of the history of science in students these mm-hmm. days. And I think it's huge. Once you start telling them about it, it's hugely entertaining.
They love it.
So I think we need to get some of that back into the curriculum as well. So.
I'm with you on that, and in fact, I'm going to be teaching a little bit at Scripps, not only tomorrow, but then later in August. We're teaching, me and Cheryl are teaching 2 days about science communication at Jeremy Jackson's class, and one of the things we're doing is we assigned a chapter from an amazing text from the history of science that nobody knows, the Marquis de Condorcet's, maybe you know it. Yeah, so sketch, you know. So anyway, he says science will save us. Science will make everyone enlightened. It will stamp out religion. Everyone will have a bullshit filter, basically. Can I say that on the Science Network? So they'll never fall for a Bernie Madoff. They'll never fall for a huckster ever again. It's like it's this great dream, and then he dies in the French Revolution.
Yeah, so. All right, but. In a jail cell for allegedly
yeah.
for having been caught for having asked for 24 boiled eggs or something in a restaurant, so thus betraying his patrician background.